I am Gail McGrew-Ifrig, and happy to see you here. The first page of the handout that some of you have is a description in a brief form of what I considered myself to be doing in the sessions that I was asked to do. When I thought about the theme of the foretaste of the feast to come, I thought, well, there are lots of wonderful feasts in literature, which is a subject I teach at Valparaiso University. And I thought that I would be able to find a good many feasts that are in books and poems that I could talk with people about, and maybe other people who like talking about those things. And I, when we were exploring those subjects together, would in that way shed some light on what we know about feasting, and that if feasting is an important metaphor in our spiritual life, when we think about the great feast, which we call the Eucharist, then maybe we could fill out our knowledge of that, not so much or not this time, by a kind of systematic theology of the Eucharist, but instead by looking at the imaginative portrayals of feasting in literature. When I thought more about that, it seemed to me that we feast because feasting meets certain human needs. And when I look carefully and try to discern what those needs are, that it seems to me that feasting meets, I came up with those 10 that are listed on that front page, and I've sort of been running down those, down that list in the last week or so. And tonight, we've had to, we've collapsed a couple of those into one and so forth. Tonight, or this afternoon, I want to spend some time, when we get to it, to reward that one of the reasons for feasting, one of the dynamics that feasting occurs with is that need that we have for reward. And so I do want to get to that and to this wonderful passage from the novel Shane by Jack Schaefer at some time today. But I know that some of you have recently seen the film Babette's Feast and have not had a chance to talk about it. And I promised that, as I have done in a good many of the sessions from the beginning, that I've had opportunity to discuss Babette's Feast and the other main text for the whole series, which is Kenneth Graham's novel, The Wind in the Willows. So this is a time when comments that you have that you would like to make about Babette's Feast are thoroughly appropriate. Maybe we could start by asking, to what extent do you think reward is part of a concept that operates in Babette's Feast? Does feasting there have any connection with reward?
Surely the for the reward, the forgiveness of all the bad feelings and that these people had towards one another, the ultimate reward was the forgiveness, or however you want to phrase the release of all the resentment towards each other that they covered over those years.
Certainly there's a huge transformation that happens at the end of, by the end of that meal, and all the feelings of guilt and shame and anger have been erased and good feelings put in their place. Does that strike you as reward in Babette's Feast? If so, I mean, maybe my thoughts about reward are different from yours.
I don't think it's about reward. I didn't see the movie yesterday, but I saw it when it came out several years ago. And what I would think about reward and Babette's feast is that the people sort of just by default got a reward. You could say they got a reward for the way they lived, which was very severe and austere.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't think that, I wouldn't have thought that she was doing it because she wanted to reward them. I mean, she didn't want to reward them because they had been brave or because they had been, you know, particularly nice to her or because they had taken her, nothing like that.
Donna?
If I think of a reward as something that you earn or deserve, they never felt they deserved any reward. They didn't. I guess I didn't think about it much until the message last night where you talked about they didn't know how to feast. They didn't want to do it. They surely didn't. It was a waste of money and all those things. So it's almost like they didn't deserve it. They didn't feel they deserved it.
I didn't see it last night either. I saw it a few years ago. I thought giving the feast was her own reward. And what else would the word have to do with it? I'm sorry I missed the first few minutes today. But, it was so much fun to watch her give the feast and prepare the feast.
Yeah, my own sense of reward as something that you earn or deserve, at least when I was thinking of feasts in literature, the ones that I could think of, the ones that occurred to me at any rate, are ones that come as a result of a person's work or effort or victory in some way. And in that sense, I thought Babette's feast shows a feast which doesn't have much to do with that, unless you could say that it is a kind of unanticipated reward that the sisters receive for their having been so good to Babette. She says at one point that she would like to do something good for them after all they have done for her. I think that Donnie is right also that in some ways reward is not a category in these people's lives. It's not really part of the way they think about experience. It is. And you don't exactly receive, you just you act according to God's will. You do what you can, and it's not particularly goal-oriented, as we would say, other than the goal of living out God's will as best they can. And I think, yeah, that passive active word is a good one in this context, because reward seems to me anyway, and we'll try this out on the passage that I select, it seems to me to come as the result of an action or an active decision or experience that one has. And it certainly may not be true of feasting overall or in general or in every case. But there are, certainly in literature, there are some great feasts that come as rewards. And I think that in human experience, it may be that feasting as a reward has some reverberations.
I know a good reward for eating. I mean, reward. If you're a wrestler, you have to make weight and then you wrestle.
Mm-hmm.
Then you can eat. And that's a reward.
For having achieved your... that is one kind of reward which might be there's a sort of sense of delayed gratification. That is, I will not eat now so that I can achieve something and eat at a later time. The feast from Beowulf was one of the first examples that, oddly enough, sprang into my mind. may not be the first word on everyone's lips. I would kind of expect that. Beowulf, a very ancient literary text, comes out of the heroic tradition, and it's one that exists for the kind of Anglo-Saxon world. I don't know the Norse sagas. Beowulf has some connection with them, although it's not in that pattern exactly. But in it, the big hero, actually the poem itself, as we have it, begins at a feast. And it begins, it's not in your handout because I just couldn't figure out where to start and stop that. So I thought I would just refer to Beowulf, and then we'll go on to a more contemporary version in Shane. But in, and I think there are some similarities, by the way, between Beowulf and Shane, but we don't have to go into those probably. But Beowulf begins at a feast, at the hall of the Lord Hrothgar. And the whole countryside has, his whole land has been under siege from a monster, and the monster's mother, Grendel is the monster, and the monster's mother, typical for women, right, never gets a name, she's just known as Grendel's mother. And the Lord and his knights have kind of given up. They're at a point where they don't have any idea what to do anymore. They've tried everything. And every night this monster just comes into the hall when they're all sleeping and grabs up a couple of the knights and takes them out, eats them up. If they ever find anything, they might find a couple of bones or an old piece of armor, but they're at a loss to know what to do because he seems so invincible. So they just send out a kind of general call, broadcast, sort of, through the network. We need a hero here. And apparently he's available, and Beowulf comes over the sea and shows up at this first scene in the poem, shows up at the hall, at the evening, at the feast. This is a kind of a low-key feast because it's half funeral and half sort of rally as they try to imagine engaging in yet another night of waiting for this monster to show up. But as they're sitting at the table, all of a sudden in comes Beowulf, who has arrived with his own little company of knights, and he says that he is not afraid. He addresses the feast in the tradition of heroic literature by giving his credentials, which means to say just how big a hero he is and how he deserves their enthusiastic belief, and that he will justify that belief, and he will do it right away. And he says to them at this very moment, he says, you seem to be here in feast, and you've been troubled, I know that. I've heard about it. It has been really bad, but you've got the right person here. Modesty was not a heroic virtue. And so, oddly enough, that actually all works just that way in the poem, as he said it would. And they are all relieved, because hearing his chanting of his the songs of his great deeds, they are all encouraged, and they throw themselves into a feasting with a will. And apparently they have a lot of mead as part of their feasting, because the poem says they're all fairly drunk when they fall asleep. And this is then the perfect lure, and as expected, the monster comes to the hall late at night, and he tries to get two more warriors for his late night snack, but as he is hauling these people out the door, Beowulf leaps up with his sword and engages in this tremendous battle, which the writer of Beowulf loves describing. So you get line after line after line after line of a bloodthirsty description of exactly what they do to each other in the course of this fight. And I am amused when I was reading this passage from Shane this afternoon, I am amused at how similar it is in kind to that description of the monster and Beowulf's fight. Because it is this sort of hard physical exertion of two very strong people, strong elements in opposition to each other, one of them human, and operating at the very high point of human exertion and strength against an opponent who seems invincible. And there is this tremendous sense of the I was even struck by the way this limbs, the root of this tree, this old stump in Shane, which the two men are trying to get out of the ground. And I was thinking, as I was reading it, of Beowulf and the description of the monster trying to get hold of Beowulf's arm. Before Beowulf gets to him, he has torn a couple of the knights in pieces. He's sort of torn their arms out of the sockets, and he sort of likes flinging their parts about. And the poet loves telling us about that. And Beowulf then gets a hold of the monster and sort of does the same thing. He pulls the monster's arm right off and ends up having to chase the monster a long distance. And then when Beowulf comes back, having chased the monster off to his pit, his lair, he lives in a big pool. Grendel, the monster has really sort of had it, and he falls down into the bottom of his pool, but Beowulf pulls off this big arm thing. It's described as kind of a arm, not arm, and it has great long nails on it. And so Beowulf brings that back, and they put that up above the door to the hall, and then they all walk underneath that big arm and go have another huge feast, this time much happier because that monster is gone. Now, what they don't know, of course, is that down in the lair is Grendel's mother, and that having her son come back armless and hurt makes her really mad, and she comes back to the hall the next night. But at the time of this big first feast, you don't know that. All you know is that, all they know, is that the monster is gone and that Beowulf himself is the sort of centerpiece of the reward that feast is going to be. But the reward, being a feast, does not go to just one person. It spreads out. It's bigger. One person's effort has won the feast in some sense. And all of them receive it, kind of, I think, in his name and on his behalf. But a feast is not for one person, although it may be occasioned by one person. So the Beowulf feast is a kind of very early and classic great example from the whole, and it is only one example from a huge tradition of feasts after battle, victory feasts, and feasts that are reward for personal achievement. And it seems to me that in neither of the two texts that I've been dealing with over a long period of time, is reward really that much an issue? And yet, I think that reward and feasting is a prominent idea, so that's why I use this section from Shane. Those of you who have it in front of you, I'm going to read parts of it so that we can enjoy it. Some of you have read it if you had it this afternoon, but others have not. If you have seen the movie Shane, which is an old movie by now, a great Western movie made in the 50s. Anybody seen Shane? You have it in your mind? Anyway. Not really. It's a classic Western in many senses. It involves a great battle between the cattle people and the farming people. The cattle people rule the valley. This is set up in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. And so it's filmed up there. Gorgeous movie. And very prominent in my own history because we were camping in Jackson that summer and that it came out, and we saw it in the Jackson Theater when it was first released. And many of the people in the audience were either in the movie or had been around while it was being filmed, and they kept yelling out and screaming, and everyone would clap about things when they saw something, or they'd say, "Oh, it's old Shorty's horse, you know, I knew them, didn't know they could get." It's a great moment in my cinema history. It was a great
one. Who were the stars of that?
Well, Alan Ladd was Shane.
Okay.
And
was a boy?
Boy was Brandon DeWilde in his second movie, I believe. He was first in Member of the Wedding and then in Shane. Jean Arthur played the mother. And Van Heflin, always one of my personal favorites, played the father. And then Jack Palance was in there in his first named screen role, anyway, as the bad guy, the heavy, the gun, the hired gun. In Shane, the farmers, the cattle people, family especially named Stryker, I think is her name, rule the valley, and the government has made the mistake of parceling out land for homesteaders who come up there to farm, which probably never should have done, but that's not the issue in the movie. These homesteaders are trying to make a living with little farms, and of course the cattle people believe that to be ruining the range. So there's a great implacable hatred between them, because the homesteaders believe that the cattle people are just trying to keep them from making a simple, honest, decent living. And the heroes of the film are the people trying to make this simple, decent living. But they have come to a point where they know they can't continue on their own anymore. They're trying to do that. They don't know what to do because they feel quite threatened by these cattle people who more and more are giving them trouble, ripping up their fences, preventing them from trying to plow and so forth. And into the valley then rides this mysterious stranger, the complete and ultimate hero. Though they have not sent for him in so many words, they have uttered a kind of cry of distress. And Shane rides into the valley, and he's also the classic Western figure, the gunslinger, who is sort of reformed. He wants not to have to be connected with his past. We never even find out a word of what that past is in the novel. And that's, I think, part of Schaefer's brilliance. He never says anything about Shane's past except to hint that it is violent and that he has done things. But such is the difference between the Anglo-Saxon motive values in this one that Shane does not brag about his past. In fact, in the mode of Western heroes, his very presence is supposed to suggest his past, so that if you see Shane, you trust him even though you know nothing about him whatsoever. He is simply heroic enough that he implicitly demands a kind of trust. Shane is in the valley, as I said, trying to escape his history, and so he comes in wearing a gun, and he takes up living with the family, who are our family. The narrator of the story is the boy, although he's telling this about his much younger years. So the narrator is not a child narrator, but the point of view is the boy in the family, and he's telling about something that happened in his youth. And the mother doesn't want this man, this hero, this gunslinger, wearing his gun. He puts it away when he comes to live there. And although he is not a homesteader or a sodbuster or any of the other nasty words, oh, another wonderful person in this movie is Ben Johnson, great Western actor and writer, who starts out in the movie working for the cattle people. And he's a bad guy, and then he switches sides. But Shane tries to make himself into a kind of homesteader. He stands with them. He works on the farm with the father. And this scene is the great sort of transition scene in that relationship. When Shane has come and they have taken him in to live in the household, and the boy is crazy about him, thinks he's, of course, wonderful. And the mother is also very attracted to him as handsome, rather dashing, quiet outsider. But the father has uncertainty about him, probably with reason. And also thinks that he doesn't know what to do around a farm or a place of work like that, that all he's good for is being a gunslinger. And the father doesn't want to have that atmosphere take over. So there is a kind of suspicion between them, even though there's a lot of good-heartedness in the father. But in this scene, the father goes out to do a chore that has been just bugging him. It's a challenge. It has been the undoable task up to this point. And he has not been able to do it, partly because he hasn't had another man. He only has had the boy, and the boy isn't strong enough. But the father decides then to go out into the yard by the farmhouse, or by their little log hut, and get rid of this stump for once and for all. It has been in the way, it's been an obstacle, it's been something that in fact stands for their inability to make a living here. And the way that the circumstances have been defeating them. So Shane watches. For a long time they're chopping at this stump with axes. And they do it for a long time and he watches them. But at the section I have begun with begins, it was no fun watching them now. They had eased down to a slow, dogged pace. Father sent me once for the hone so they could sharpen the blades, and again for a spade so he could clear the dirt away from the lowest roots, and I realized he might keep me running as long as I was handy. I slipped off by myself to see how Mother's garden was doing after the rain, and maybe add to the population in the box of worms I was collecting for when I would go fishing with the boys in town. I took my time about it. I played pretty far afield, but no matter where I went, always I could hear that chopping in the distance. You could not help beginning to feel tired just to hear it, to think how they were working and staying at it. Now, this long is a long section in the story. When he goes to his mother's kitchen, she whispered, in some ways those two aren't even as old as you are, Bob, just the same. Don't you dare tell them I said so, but there's something splendid in the battle they're giving that old monster. And ting, you know, my little bells go off there. This is a battle against a monster. It has been, it presents a difficulty about using the yard, this farmyard where they are trying to work between the house and the barn and so forth, and has caused them problems. But the way he goes about it, the way the father goes about it, and that Shane has begun to work with him, not saying anything. He didn't ask Shane to help him, and Shane didn't say anything. He just went and picked up another axe to work. She whisked about the kitchen, and in almost no time at all, she had a pan of biscuits in the oven. While they were baking, she took her hat and carefully sewed the old ribbon into its old place. She said, more to herself than to me. You'd think I'd learn. This isn't Dodge City. This isn't even a whistle stop. It's where I'm proud to be. Out came the biscuits. She piled as many as she could on a plate, popping one of the leftovers into her mouth and giving me the rest. She picked up the plate and marched with it out behind the barn. She stepped over the cut roots and set the plate on a fairly smooth spot on top of the stump. She looked at the two men, first one and then the other. You're a pair of fools, she said, but there's no law against me being a fool, too. Without looking at either of them again, she marched away, her head high, back toward the house. The two of them stared after her till she was out of sight. They turned to stare at the biscuits. Father gave a deep sigh, so deep it seemed to come all the way from his heavy work shoes. There was nothing sad or sorrowful about it. There was just something in him too big to be held tight in comfort. He let his axe fall to the ground. He leaned forward and separated the biscuits into two piles beside the plate, counting them even. One was left on the plate. He set this by itself on the stump. He took up his axe and reached it out and let it drop gently on the lone biscuit exactly in the middle. He rested the axe against the stump and took the two halves of the biscuit and put one on each pile. He did not say a word to Shane. He pitched into one pile and Shane did into the other, and the two of them faced each other over the last uncut roots, munching at those biscuits as if eating them was the most serious business they had ever done. Father finished his pile and dabbled his fingers on the plate for the last crumbs. He straightened and stretched his arms high and wide. He seemed to stretch and stretch until he was a tremendous tower of strength reaching up into the late afternoon sun. He swooped suddenly to grab the plate and toss it to me. Still in the same movement, he seized his axe and swung it in a great arc into the root he was working on. Quick as he was, Shane was right with him, and together they were talking again to that old stump. In the next part of the selection, the mother begins making a pie. And she has the boy fill up the wood box, and he occupies himself as well as he can, trying to stay out of Aaron's way. Let's see. But finally he's pulled back to this scene of this battle, and he goes back again. As I watched, he laid the spade aside and put his shoulder to the stump. He heaved against it. Sweat started to pour down his face. There was a little sucking sound, and the stump moved ever so slightly. That did it. Of a sudden, I was so excited that I could hear my own blood pounding past my eardrums. I wanted to dash to that stump and push it and feel it move, only I knew Father would think I was in the way. Shane finished the root and came to help him. Together, they heaved against the stump. It angled up nearly a whole inch. You could begin to see an open space in the dirt where it was ripping loose. But as soon as they released the pressure, it fell back. Again and again, they heaved at it. Each time, it would angle up a bit farther. Each time, it would fall back. They had it up once about a foot and a half, and that was the limit. They could not get past it. They stopped, breathing hard, mighty streak now from the sweat rivulets down their faces. Father peered underneath as best he could. "Must be a taproot," he said. That was the one time either of them had spoken to the other, as far as I knew, the whole afternoon through. Father did not say any more, and Shane said nothing. He just picked up his axe and looked at Father and waited. Father began to shake his head. There was some unspoken thought between them that bothered him. He looked down at his own big hands, and slowly the fingers curled until they were clenched into big fists. Then his head stopped shaking, and he stood taller, and he drew a deep breath. He turned and backed in between two cut root ends, pressing against the stump. He pushed his feet into the ground for firm footholds. He bent his knees and slid his shoulders down the stump and wrapped his big hands around the root ends. Slowly he began to straighten. Slowly that huge old stump began to rise. Up it came, inch by inch, till the side was all the way up to the limit they had reached before. Shane stooped to peer under. He poked his axe into the opening, and I heard it strike wood. But the only way he could get in position to swing the axe into the opening was to drop on his right knee and extend his left leg and thigh into the opening and lean his weight on them. Then he could bring the axe sweeping in at a low angle close to the ground. He flashed one quick glance at Father beside and behind him, eyes closed, muscles locked in that great sustained effort, and he dropped into position with the whole terrible weight of the stump poised above nearly half his body and sent the axe sweeping under in swift, powerful strokes. Suddenly, Father seemed to slip, only he had not slipped. He had straightened even further. The stump had leaped up a few more inches. Shane jumped out and up and tossed his axe aside. He grabbed one of the root ends and helped Father ease the stump down. They were both blowing like they'd run a long way, but they would not stay more than a minute before they were heaving again at the stump. It came up more easily now, and the dirt was tearing loose all around it. I ran to the house fast as I could. I dashed into the kitchen and took hold of Mother's hand. "Hurry," I yelled. "You've got to come." She did not seem to want to come at first, and I pulled at her. "You've got to see it. They're getting it out." Then she was as excited as I was and was running right with me. So far in that scene, one of the terrific things is that unspoken between the two men. Can Shane trust the father to hold the stump while he gets underneath the stump and underneath its weight in the ground and risks his own life and limb, and that the other man will protect him from that danger? Can that trust happen? Can Joe hold the stump? Shane is sort of assessing the other man's strength. They're kind of, you know, like two heroes looking at each other in this endeavor. Can they each be trusted? And then the trust is given. Shane leaps underneath while Joe holds the tree up. I think there's a wonderful sense that Schaefer has all through this section of heroic literature and the heroic effort undertaken here, both in individual exertion, but then in this combination, the two heroes working together to achieve it. They had the stump way up at an angle. They were down in the hole, one on each side of it, pushing up and forward with hands flat on the underpart, reared before them higher than their heads. You would have thought the stump was ready to topple over, clear of its ancient foundation, but there it stuck. They could not quite push it the final inches. Mother watched them battling with it. "Joe," she called, "why don't you use some sense? Hitch up the team. Horses will have it out in no time at all." Then this great classic heroic sort of answer. Father braced himself to hold the stump still. He turned his head to look at her. "Horses," he shouted. All the pent silence of the two of them that long afternoon through was being shattered in the one wonderful shout. "Horses! Great jumping Jehoshaphat! No, we started this with manpower, and by Godfrey, we'll finish it with manpower." He turned his head to face the stump once more and dropped it lower between his humped shoulders. Shane opposite him stiffened, and together they pushed in a fresh assault. The stump quivered and swayed a little and hung fixed at its crazy high angle. Father grunted in exasperation. You could see the strength building up in his legs and broad shoulders and big corded arms. His side of the upturned stump rocked forward, and Shane's side moved back, and the whole stump trembled like it would twist down and into the hole on them at a grotesque new angle. I wanted to shout a warning, but I could not speak, for Shane had thrown his head in a quick sideways gesture to fling his hair from falling over his face, and I had caught a glimpse of his eyes. They were aflame with a concentrated cold fire. Not another separate, discernible movement did he make. It was all of him, the whole man, pulsing in one incredible surge of power. You could fairly feel the fierce energy suddenly burning in him, pouring through him in a single coordinated drive. His side of the stump rocked forward even with Father's, and the whole mass of the stump tore loose from the last hole and toppled away to sprawl in ungainly defeat beyond them. There's certainly in all of that description is the sense of that stump as monster. It has limbs like arms and legs with which it is fighting the humans poised against it and operating against it. So that Schaefer has really worked, I think, to endow this struggle with a heroic dimension. And that's partly because For Schaefer, the whole wide range of the story has a heroic dimension. It's a doomed dimension in that sense, because this battle between cattlemen and farmers in areas that can't be farmed is a doomed battle. When we watch Shane, we want the farm people to win, even though we may know enough about agriculture and mountains and dry plains to know that they could beat off the cattle people and still not be able to make a living there. But this heroic struggle with the stump is a great classic battle in the literature. It seems to the reader, to us as readers, as though the end of the battle should be the end of the battle. They get out of the hole with the stump, they walk toward each other, and then the boy realizes that he is shouting a high-pitched, wordless shout. But he stops shouting. I thought they should join hands so close on the bole of the stump. I thought they should at least say something to each other. They stood quiet and motionless. At last, Father turned and came toward Mother. He was so tired that the weariness showed in his walk, but there was no weariness in his voice. Marian, he said, I'm rested now. I don't believe any man since the world began was ever more rested. A heroic understatement or overstatement together. Shane, too, was coming toward us. He, too, spoke only to Mother. Ma'am, I've learned something today. Being a farmer has more to it than I ever thought. Now I'm about ready for some of that pie. Mother had been watching them in a wide-eyed wonder. At his last words, she let out a positive wail. Oh, you men, you made me forget about it. It's probably all burned. And she was running for the house so fast she was tripping over her skirt. The pie was burned all right. We could smell it when we were in front of the house, and the men were scrubbing themselves at the pump trough. Mother had the door open to let the kitchen air out. The noises from inside sounded as if she might be throwing things around. Kettles were banging and dishes were clattering. When we went in, we saw why. She had the table set and was putting supper on it, and she was grabbing the things from their places and putting them down on the table with solid thumps. She would not look at one of us. We sat down and waited for her to join us. She put her back to us and stood by the low shelf near the stove, staring at her big pie tin and the burned stuff in it. Finally, Father spoke kind of sharply. Look here, Marian, aren't you ever going to sit down? She whirled and glared at him. I thought maybe she'd been crying, but there were no tears on her face. It was dry and pinched-looking, and there was no color in it. Her voice was sharp like Father's. I was planning to have a deep-dish apple pie. Well, I will. None of your silly man foolishness is going to stop me. So she starts in then to build up the fire again and to make another pie. She scrubs the pie tin. Father's face was getting red. He picked up his fork to begin eating and let it drop with a little clatter. He squirmed on his chair and kept taking quick side looks at her. She finished scrubbing the tin and went to the apple barrel and filled her wooden bowl with fat round ones. She sat by the stove and started peeling them. Father fished in a pocket and pulled out his own jackknife, his old jackknife. He moved over to her, stepping softly. He reached out for an apple to help her. She did not look up, but her voice caught him like she'd flicked him with a whip. Joe Start, don't you dare touch one of those apples. He was sheepish as he returned to his chair. Then he was downright mad. He grabbed his knife and fork and dug into the food on his plate, taking big bites and chewing vigorously. There was nothing for our visitor and me to do but follow his example. Maybe it was a good supper. I could not tell. The food was only something to put in your mouth. When we finished, there was nothing to do but wait, because Mother was sitting by the stove, arms folded, staring at the wall, waiting herself for her pie to bake. We three watched her in a quiet so tight that it hurt. We could not help it. We would try to look away, and always our eyes would turn back to her. She did not appear to notice us. You might have said she'd forgotten we were there. She had not forgotten, because as soon as she sensed that the pie was done, she lifted it out, cut 4 wide pieces, and put them on plates. The first 2 she set in front of the 2 men, the 3rd one she set down for me, the last one she laid at her own place, and she sat down in her own chair at the table. Her voice was still sharp. "I'm sorry to keep you men waiting so long. Your pie is ready now." Father inspected his portion like he was afraid of it. He needed to make a real effort to take his fork and lift a piece. He chewed on it and swallowed, and he flipped his eyes sideways at Mother and back again quickly to look across the table at Shane. "That's prime pie," he said. Shane raised a piece on his fork. He considered it closely. He put it in his mouth and chewed on it gravely. "Yes," he said. The quizzical expression on his face was so plain you could not possibly miss it. "Yes, that's the best bit of stump I ever tasted." What could a silly remark like that mean? I had no time to wonder, for Father and Mother were acting so queer. They both stared at Shane and their mouths were sagging open. Then Father snapped his shut and he chuckled and chuckled till he was swaying in his chair. "By Godfrey, Marion, he's right. You've done it too." Mother stared from one of them to the other of them. Her pinched look faded and her cheeks were flushed and her eyes were soft and warm as they should be. And she was laughing so that the tears came. And all of us were pitching into that pie. And the one thing wrong in the whole world was that there was not enough of it. What?
What a wonderful story.
It is a wonderful story. It's a great book. A much overlooked great piece of American literature, in my opinion. I would think that anybody whose mind is sort of working on the level of feasting would have lots of resonances in that passage. Probably, certainly one of them would have been where they sit down to the supper that's put in front of them, and the boy says, "Maybe it was a good supper, I could not tell. The food was only something to put in your mouth." And then that's contrasted with the moment when they're eating the pie, where Shane says it was the best piece of stump he ever tasted. That what the eating is what you understand it to be. And the eating and the achievement or the reward for the victory are one thing. They are not separable. At least that's what the adults understand very well. The child is really not, he senses it in a way, but he doesn't understand Shane's point enough. He says he thinks that's a funny sort of remark. The adults understand it perfectly well. The feast is also an achievement that marks the achievement with the stump, so that they blend into one thing. They become one experience. And there is a sense that without the pie, the experience of getting the stump out would be incomplete. It certainly would be incomplete as the whole little unit of the 4 of them could experience it. It's only when, and there's that terrible moment of when that celebration, that feast, that contribution that she makes to the achievement, when that's balked or frustrated, then there is no celebration. There's no way to get into the feeling of complete victory and satisfaction. So her understanding of that is such that she refuses to be defeated at that moment by the circumstance of having burned the pie. And in spite of the difficulty, the tremendous difficulty of going back and doing this long process over, especially in these circumstances with the wood-burning stove and the fire having gone down and all sorts of things, she starts right in back at the beginning and does the whole thing over again, so that the celebration can be complete, so that everyone there in that unit will be satisfied.
Never does it say that she said I've earned the pie. She said, you men made me burn the pie.
She says the pie is burned, yeah. She says, you men made me burn the pie.
You men made me burn the pie.
Well, she says...
And she had this burn going all this time. And this whole is the scene of anger at the men, I thought.
It's anger, I just thought she was...
I just wondered.
Well, I think she's...
I mean, it seems a very kind of selfish anger. And that sort of diminishes the joy of the pie. It diminishes the joy of everything. She said, you had your great victory, and now I'm ticked.
And I thought she was so happy that she was just like, I was so involved.
Oh, see, we like to talk from different sides of it.
Yeah, well, anyone else can enter in too. Certainly she's angry. I mean, that's there. As they are angry at the stump. I mean, there is an anger, it seems to me, born of the frustration of opposition. I mean, there is the desire so strong to complete the activity. And that desire, which throws itself into action so fully.
They couldn't use horses, and she couldn't use a borrowed knife.
she wouldn't use any borrowed help either. Yeah, because that was her achievement to do, mm-hmm. and to recognize their achievement. And it had to be done that way. I think we talked yesterday, is it only yesterday, about ceremony? There is a ceremony to this also, isn't there? Because they're the ones to do the stump, she's the one to do the pie. And the ethos here is not one in which those roles shift around. They are rightly done when each does what he does. Shane makes a little statement, being a farmer has more to it than I ever thought. He is brought into the ethos of this achievement, though he didn't know it, at least he didn't know it experientially to begin with. He had tended to discount these farm-type chores as being not as manly, perhaps, as his own achievements. But each of them has these roles to do. Not to be able to achieve it, I think you're right, is to produce anger. And that there is a kind of explosive energy with the anger that makes each of these persons push through to the last completion. So that her being frustrated in being able to get the pie done right to begin with and having to do it over is similar, I think, to the way that the scene with the stump is described. It is their unwillingness to not be able to do the thing that causes that anger, which gives them the strength to do it.
I have a question about how we couldn't tell if it was a good meal or not because it didn't matter. And I thought that really surprised me because I was like, you know that they really want to have the pie. Mm-hmm. But what's wrong with the rest of the meal that they don't even notice it?
Well, what do you think? What's
wrong?
Because
they're so caught up in what's going on with her that they have
she's
to. They feel bad that she's not participating. That she's not, participating with them in the meal that she's prepared, and that she's so focused on making this pie, and so they don't taste it because they're concerned with what's going on with her.
But the pie is the ultimate. They do praise her for the pie, and the pie is like the stump. Mm-hmm. The meal isn't, to me, like the stump. The pie is more like the stump than the meal.
She starts to make that pie early on when she tells him to fill up the wood box so she can really fire up the stove to make a pie. She starts that in about the middle of their work, or somewhere in the time that they're doing the stump, as her contribution to this effort and the celebration of their victory. So that I think that we are right to read a distinction between the meal as such and the pie. That's what marks the real achievement. But it is also, I think, meaningful here in terms of the feast that is the reward. It cannot be a feast or a reward or the satisfaction of all unless they're all able to do it. And she cannot sit and eat that meal. And the fact that one of the four of them can't do it, that circle is broken, means that that's not a meal that they even taste. That's just something you put in your mouth. It's not even, it doesn't count. And I think that's a wonderful insight that we have about the difference between meals where food is just something you put in your mouth, which if you ever sat at a table with your family and everybody's mad at everybody, or one person's really mad, or people are unhappy. I mean, you do put food into your mouth, but it just chokes you and feels awful. Seems to me I've had a few suppers like that. And they're painful. You do eat the food, but it doesn't feel like food at any other, at right times at all. It's just pure vitamins or nutrition. It has none of what we desire from a meal. Other things you notice about the dynamics here and this piece of stump that forms a feast? Cindy?
This has been real fun though to hear about Shane again, because it's been a long time.
Yeah. Well, I watched it not too long ago, and although I find that the terrible irony of the failure of homesteading in the Western United States makes it more ironic. It still is a wonderful movie. It holds up beautifully, I think. It's well made, great performances by all kinds of people. And the scenery is enough just by itself without, if all the dialogue were cut out, just to look at the mountains would be wonderful. I think that I have put on tomorrow's schedule timelessness, and the piece of literature that I have sort of chosen certainly will get back to a piece of Wind in the Willows. I also have a nice little chunk of The Last Battle from the Narnia books that I found the other day that I think is really wonderful, apropos of feasting and timelessness. But the piece that's in this handout that I would think most about for tomorrow is Dylan Thomas's prose recollection called Child's Christmas in Wales.